This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in cultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. I'm delighted today to be speaking with Dr. Gabriel Yoran about his new book, The Interfact, on Structure and Compatibility in Object-Oriented Ontology. Gabriel Yoran is both an entrepreneur and an author. He recently published another book in German called Warum heißt es Traum und nicht Memory-Schaum? Today, we'll be discussing The Interfact, published in 2021 with Open Humanities Press. Dr. Yoran, welcome to the show.
Adam, thanks for having me.
Could you talk a little bit about yourself and your inspiration for writing this book?
Yeah, so my start in getting interested in object-oriented ontology was actually by accident, because I started my professional life as a software developer. And in software development, there is a concept called object-oriented programming. And when I heard about object-oriented ontology, which was in a class that Graham Harman, who coined the term, gave, I approached him after the class and I told him there is so many similarities between object-oriented ontology and object-oriented programming. This can't be by accident. Like, I bet you have a background in programming. And he was, no, I actually don't. Like, I know that there is something like object-oriented programming, but I have no idea what it is. And I said, this can't be real. Like, has no one ever approached you about this? Like, aren't there books about this? And at that time, that was in 2013, I guess, there weren't. And so I looked into this and I researched this, and I thought in the beginning, this is what I'm going to write a PhD thesis about, like about the parallels between these two things. And it ended up being in the thesis. It also ended up being in the Interfact book, but it only became a stepstone to further thinking about object-oriented ontology. And so I felt that at some point in 2013, 2014, I was in a random but very privileged position of talking about object-oriented ontology in a way that hasn't been done before. And in thousands of years of the history of philosophy, you don't get to do that very often. So that's where this whole endeavor started.
Perhaps we could start with an overview of OOO for the listeners.
Yeah, so OOO, object-oriented ontology, is a train of thought, a school, if you will, under a bigger umbrella called speculative realism, which again is a group of realisms. So if you're vaguely familiar with philosophical terms, which I don't know about the audience, I guess some might be, basically these, realism means all kinds of philosophies that state that there is a world independent of our observing it, of measuring it, of looking at. There are independent things in the world, independent of, for example, our perception of them. That sounds pretty normal for people not in philosophy, but in philosophy that's a big thing, because there are competing schools that are way more popular, idealism, for example. So the interesting thing is that this school that has been kind of discarded as naive and a bit stupid and simplistic made such a comeback with something that doesn't really look like a proper realism at all. So that's a critique that often is uttered about speculative realism. Is that a realism? It's kind of strange. And the proponents of this school also talk of their thoughts as a strange realism. Even Graham Harman, who's one of the main people in this movement, calls this philosophy strange. And we'll get to that later, I think. But so what does it do? Why is it different, or what in which regard does it differ from previous schools of thought? So the main idea, or the main criticism of other schools of thought that object-oriented ontology poses, is that it basically accuses other trains of thought as undermining or overmining the world. So what does undermining, overmining mean? Undermining means reducing objects to their parts. For example, you look at a chair and you would be asked, what is this object? What is a chair? And an undermining person would say, it's made of these atoms, and these atoms are made of even smaller pieces, and that's what a chair is. It's this structure made of tiny parts. And that person probably wouldn't be wrong, but it's not the whole truth, because then there's the overmining position, stating that reducing objects, objects are their effects and their context. A chair is something that can be used to sit on it at a table, for example, and it has legs or something. And yeah, that's not wrong either, but they are overmining. They're ignoring a huge part of what a chair is. And Graham Harman says most people actually do duo mining. That's his term, which is a combination of undermining and overmining. So I guess if you would ask anyone what is a chair, and you give them these two options, they would probably agree that both seem pretty good. Both seem correct. And OOO says, yes, but that can't be it, because they're always reducing the thing, in this case, the chair, to something else. So they're not talking about the chair. They're talking about tiny parts, or they're talking about the use of the chair and the thing in itself, to use that term, very that ominous term, gets lost. So what happened to this? What happened to the chair? So, and that's a very, very good question. And it seems very simple, but it's exceptionally hard to answer. And what Harman tries to do, and in object-oriented ontology, is to say, yes, the towering figure of Western philosophy, Immanuel Kant, was right. Like, there are these things outside of our, like, outside of our minds that we can't have real access to. Like, we will never really know them. There's always a mystery. But he says this is not the whole truth, because he calls this this kind of philosophy correlationist philosophies, or uses a term called ontotaxonomy. Like, this is all very technical, but it basically means thinking of the world as split in two parts, or thinking of everything as split in two parts, the stuff that's in your mind and the other stuff, and which creates kind of like paradoxical problems. Like, if you have something in your mind, how does that relate to the things that are outside your mind? And is there something outside of your mind? Realists would say yes, but that's just the realist perspective. And how does the stuff inside your mind relate to the stuff outside your mind? So these are all of these kinds of questions that you would ask when you're a correlationist. And a lot of people agree that this is how the world is. Like, this is basically what people think of, like what a lot of Western philosophers think of the world since Kant or even before. Harman says, and not just Harman, like the whole speculative realism movement says, no, that's not the whole thing, because this rift between you and the world, it's not the only rift that's there. The rift is between everything. So Kant was right, but he didn't go far enough. That's what Harman usually says, right? So we can't stop at the rift between humans, human beings, their mind, and the rest of the world. Like, it can't be true that this is what the cosmos circles around. This is an anthropocentric perspective, so it puts man or mankind in the center, and we are in the process of as mankind, we are in the process of destroying the planet we live on. And so, yes, we have tremendous effect on our planet, but other planets couldn't care less. Like, there are other worlds, there are other galaxies, it would be like, it's very easy to make the point to say it makes no sense that this is how we should cut the world, us against the world. And so object-oriented ontology wants to overcome this by introducing a lot of new terms and a very different model of looking at the world and of looking at yourself and of trying to speculate about how a world would look like if you're not stuck in the position it's my mind or our minds against everything else. Hope that makes kind of sense.
And the guiding question behind this book is really, what is an object, right? Which ought to be a fairly easy question to answer in OOO. But you notice that there are actually some problems in arriving at this easy answer, right? So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I struggled with that problem for years, because on the one hand, I wanted to find an answer to that question, of course, but on the other hand, the struggle is part of the point. Like, the fact that an object is not as easy to grasp is kind of the point. So I was trying to do something impossible, if you will, because the key characteristics of objects in triple O is that they are independent, or in a certain way independent, from their context and from their inner workings. So both can change to a certain extent, yet the object stays the same. And since I heard this, I was wondering about, okay, who gets to decide? Like, it stays the same. Okay, I agree. The River Rhine, for example, changes every second. It also stays the same. If we change, like if we add a canal, or if we like add buildings to the shoreline, or it changes, but it also stays the same. So what would we have to do for it not to stay the same? And who gets to decide? Interestingly, Triple O doesn't talk about that. And I was wondering why. So I was thinking about this using the theories that I knew from computer science. So what are objects in object-oriented programming? How do we identify them? And how can we say these are the same or still the same? And so a major similarity between these two concepts, the one in computer science and the one in ontology or in philosophy, is that there is an inside and an outside of an object. So an object has inner workings that are somehow withdrawn. So that's a term that Triple O borrows from Heidegger. Yeah, where one of the few philosophers actually talking about stuff and things, right? And our relation to things, where that wasn't done for most of the time, where we talked about the mind, ideas, and the world, and you know, and knowledge. And so in the 20th century, we started thinking about things. And so there is an inside and an outside to things or to objects. And the inside is to a large part unknown, or can't be known, or is withdrawn. And the outside, there is what in computer science is called interfaces. So these are defined connection points to the object, but they are not the object. They are just like access points, like tiny doors or windows, and or outlets, if you will. Sometimes they're even called outlets, and you can put a plug in there that fits the outlet perfectly. But you wouldn't exhaust the object by doing that. You would still not know exactly what's going on in there. But you would have like a defined way of talking to the object. Like the object would talk to the piece of software that would use the object. So for example, in object-oriented programming, things that you see on your computer screen are represented by objects. So you see a window on your desktop screen, on your computer screen, that's an object. You see a button on that window, that's an object too. In computer science, often these objects form hierarchies. So there's concepts like inheritance, where you have a specific kind of object that inherits properties, characteristics, and functionality from their parent object. So for example, a button on the screen is also a window of sorts. Like it inherits everything that a window can do. So it can be smaller or bigger, it can be closed or open, it can be active or inactive, it will have a certain color, etc. All of these things are true for windows. They're also true for buttons. So in this hierarchy, like this is true for the Windows operating system, for macOS, and probably for a ton of other systems. An object button is also in a way a window. So, and you can now, as a software developer, you can talk to that window and you can say, okay, minimize it, make it bigger, make it smaller, make it change the color, put some text in it. But you do that through these interfaces. So it's kind of you get to talk to the thing in a certain way. You get to talk to the thing in a certain way, and it will answer in a certain way. So it will do this. It will change the appearance of the window, etc. But what actually happens on the inside, like how it does this, you have no idea as the software developer, usually. Because the object has been created by some other developer and you might not be able to look inside. And so you have to depend on the interfaces. And the insides of this object, its functionality, its inner workings, may change any time. They even might change while the program is running. And you, as the software developer, you would have no idea that this is happening. And actually, you don't care that much, because usually it's a pretty reliable thing to talk through these interfaces. And the only thing is, the interface, once the interface changes, and not just like incrementally adding more plugs to it, but changing the form of the plugs, changing the appearance of the plugs, changing the way you connect to it, then the whole thing falls apart. Then the object is not the same anymore. So if you have to stop interfacing to it the same way you did in the past, then for object-oriented programming, we're talking a different object. It's not the same. There are other definitions. There are other ways of talking about objects. Like you can have multiple instances of the same object. Like you can have 10 windows on the screen, but they're all just different instances of the same object. This is something you can't have in object-oriented ontology, where every object is a unique thing in its own right. There are no copies or instances of objects. But that's a different story. So I thought, okay, an object falls apart when their interface falls apart, like when I cannot connect to the object anymore. And then, of course, you have to ask, who is this I? Like, I cannot connect to this object anymore. If I ask this question, am I destroying the realism? Like, am I just like making this a correlationist philosophy again by making it about my relation to it, making the things about how I relate to them? And I didn't want to do this because that it felt wrong. And I absolutely believe that a realist perspective is a correct perspective, with like some caveats and some fine print, but so how do we think about objects that have this independence, that have these mysterious inner workings, but that can change to a certain extent and stay the same, and can change above and beyond that extent and break and become something else? So how do we do this? And I thought, and that's the point that I make in the Interfect book, I thought that object-oriented ontology, for strategic reasons, doesn't go down that road, because it's dangerous, because it's kind of a realistic brand name, right? You want to hurt the the idea of this very interesting, exciting, realist perspective on the world that's not boring at all. And you don't want to be lumped in with the folks that saying everything is just one, and like these esoteric principles are these ancient ideas of the Aperon, like an indeterminate lump where everything emerges from. And so how do you do this? And the other question that comes up here, or the other problem that comes up here, is, are we still discussing an ontological question, like about what the world is made of, or how things are in the world? I mean, ontologists aren't even sure what ontology is about. Like, there's a ton of definitions about this again. Or are we talking epistemology? Like, are we talking about how do we perceive these objects, and how is our perception being put into this? And an early version of the Interfact had the subtitle "On the Co-creation of Objects," and I removed that because it kind of, like, I ran the risk of making people think, okay, we're not, this is a destructive criticism of a realist philosophy, which it absolutely is not. I'm very sympathetic to object-oriented ontology. The difference is, I think it can be pushed further without being destroyed by acknowledging that objects are always somehow connectable or compatible to other objects in the world.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so I started talking about compatibility. So that's in the title of the book, of course. So compatibility means, do these interfaces click? Like, are we able to connect? And by we, I mean that in the triple O-ist sense of the word, basically everything, anything. Like a rock connecting to the river it's in. Country or a state connecting to the union it's in. Styrofoam, Timothy Morton's favorite thing, connecting to time, like the thing that we have put into the world that will outlast everything. There will be styrofoam in the world when everything else is gone. And we made this. So that's a different strain of speculative realism that Timothy Morton goes for, where he talks about hyper objects, yeah, objects that are excessively extended in time and space, and bigger for too big to grasp, like climate change, for example, is an object for Timothy Morton. And it probably is an object for Graham Harman too. And it's just a very big thing that can be related to, that can be interfaced with. And a lot of the problems that we see today is the inability or the unwillingness to interface with these things. Until and beyond the point of denying the existence of things, which is interesting because you can only deny the existence of things that in some way are there. Like you need the thing, even if it's just like an imaginary thing, you need a thing to deny it. And there's a lot of this going on, but I'm getting astray here. The question, to come back to your question, what is an object or how do I work with this problem, is when we agree that objects are not just like a mental construction, and we agree that there is a world outside the mind, and we agree that there is a rift between all objects, but there is still some way to touch between these objects, a way of touching. That's the term that Triple O uses. Objects touch or confront each other. So there is something going on between all objects, or at least potentially between all objects. And so what is that? In object-oriented ontology, there is a model that's being introduced, which is called the quadruple object. And the quadruple object posits that there are four poles in every object: a sensual object, a real object, sensual qualities, and real qualities. So these are four what is called poles. And just to make this a bit easier to grasp, if we just focus on, let's say, the real object and the sensual object for a minute. So the real object is the part of an object that's the withdrawn part. That's the part that we cannot access. That not just we cannot access, that's inaccessible. So every object has this. So every object is, in its totality, ungraspable. Like we will never have full access to it. And by we, I mean everything. Like there is no full access to an object. You can look at the chair, you can have other people look at the chair, you can put the chair in a world where there's no people at all, and whatever you do or don't do, you will not get to the bottom of the chair. That's something that is very strange for a realist philosophy, because it's not naive at all. Like, it's very mysterious and it's very strange. Like, we make the point as realists that, yes, the chair exists, and it exists independent of my perception of it. But I'm not 100% sure what it is, and no one is. So that's the real object part. The sensual object part is how it appears, how it seems to be, and not just for me. And that's where the interesting realist part comes in. So, while if I start with myself, I would have to acknowledge I have a sensual object and a real object too. Like there is stuff inside me as a person that I do not understand and that I'm not able to fully grasp, and no one is. But then there's also the part of me that appears to the outside, and that can be interfaced with.
like, for example, my ability to speak a certain language. That's an interface in a way. Or the way I look, if you are able to see. And Triple O says that a central object can never directly connect to another central object. There's always a real object in between. And a real object can never connect to another real object. There's always a central object in between. So it's this back and forth. There is no direct connection, never. So if I look at an object and the model says it consists of a central and a real object pole, and I connect to this, my real object connects to this other real object, we co-create a central object. I think it follows necessarily from the theory. And this is where it becomes kind of problematic for Triple O as I found it back in 2015, 16, 17, when I wrote the book, is that Triple O always looks at the object in itself and looks at these, at this fourfold, as it's called, another term borrowed from Heidegger, the central object, the real object, the central qualities, the real qualities. And they're completely on their own. Like they're like an island in the ocean. And I was wondering, whose central object am I looking at when I look at this fourfold? Is it as the how the object appears to me? Is it how the object appears to like the ocean, the rock in the river, the English language, the atmosphere? I don't know. And so if a central object can only come into existence by two real objects touching, then an object cannot be on its own as long as we say it always has a central object part. There must be some kind of connection, even like a very weak one, perhaps just a potential of a connection, but there has to be something. And this is where I thought, yeah, this is an interface. This is an interface. You don't have to use it. There is no need. You don't even have to be aware of it. It can be like hard to use. It can be undocumented, so you don't know about it. But if it doesn't have an interface, if there is no if there's not the slightest possibility to do something, to touch, to confront, to interact with the object. And I'm not talking of like human interaction, I'm talking any kind of confrontation, any object at all. What is this thing then? It's obviously not on the same plane of reality than everything else. So I would say it doesn't exist. So I would go as far as saying if it doesn't have any interfaces, there's no use in talking about this. it feels wrong in this theory. And I'm not negating the fact that objects withdraw and that objects are mysterious and cannot be exhausted. Absolutely not. I'm just saying, as long as we say that objects in object-oriented ontology necessarily have a central object component or pole, there has to be at least one other real object to co-create this central object. So if I look at something, that something and I together, we co-create the central object. And if the glass of water is on the table, the glass and the table co-create the central object. That is how the glass and the table are like physically in that, for example, confronting each other. So that totally works outside of like mind world relationships or and so if you continue to think about this, you'll get to very uncomfortable points where you think, okay, if an object cannot be alone or solitary, as long as there is a central part to it, and that it has to connect to at least one, or at least be able to connect, or, and that's of course true for the other object too, and so on and so on. So in the end, shouldn't there be an object that somehow represents the possibility, the potential for all objects somehow to relate, to interface with each other? So I called that the pan object, for lack of a better term. And I'm not even saying that this is like already an original thought, because it's basically just like rigorously applying what was there in object-oriented ontology. Just thinking, what happens if I take this fourfold model seriously? And I would say this is where this leads. But it doesn't necessarily mean that like everything is one, because that's not what this says. This just says objects have to have at least one interface. And if that breaks, okay, then it's a different object. Fine. If it persists through time, it's the same object, because we cannot talk about the real object. Like, we will never know what's going on there. But, and not just we, like, nothing. And so we have to admit that if we look at what we can look at, and that's the sensual object part, then this is how we identify an object. This is how an object can be identified. And if these interfaces fall apart, it's a different object, regardless of what's going on the inside. And so when looking at this and when thinking of this as this network, or as a mesh, which also is a term that Timothy Morton uses, and you think of it as something that is not equally dense everywhere, then this is the point where I came to think of this portmanteau word interfact, which conflates interface and fact, because I thought at some point what this structure does is it stabilizes reality in a way. And it does that by conflating things that are things and relations that in philosophy I think are often viewed as very different things, namely ontology and epistemology. So what is the world made of? How are things in the world, and how do we perceive them? And aren't there, like in the extreme speculative realism sense, aren't there epistemic processes between objects that are like not known to have like a mind? Like, it sounds a bit mysterious and esoteric, so I don't want to go there, but I think it's possible to think about object-oriented ontology as something that has a relationist, an important relationist part to it, without being correlationist. It does not depend on human world relation. This is not what this critique is about. So I'm not trying to get a human world ontological priority in through the back door in the interfact. I'm not interested in that. But I'm very much interested in the fact that objects as described in Harman's fourfold are always half sensual, and this sensual part and the fact that an object cannot be completely isolated, this is why we can identify objects. It might be poor, it might not be perfect, we're not getting at the root of the thing, but we can talk about them, we can identify them, and we can agree or disagree on an object not being the same anymore. Even if we disagree, we have a reference point to talk about. And the fact that in some areas this fabric is more dense or is not equally dense everywhere means that there are a lot of epistemic processes taking place in one part or one zone of it and close to nowhere somewhere else. That would be absolutely possible. And I think that objects that can be identified more easily than others are more easily identifiable because there is a stronger density of objects relating to that object in a certain part of this fabric. And this density, this saturation of relations is what I would say, this is what we call facts. It's a certain density of relations. And so the pan object is just kind of a stepstone to the notion of the interfacts. The pan object follows necessarily from what Trapelot posits, I would say. It's not a fully formed original thought. It's just a stepstone. And while I'm not really interested in making statements about whether there is an all-encompassing object or not, it just follows logically from Trapelot's premises as I read it. And I'm very interested in insisting on the fact that objects need other objects to become objects for other objects. So while at the same time holding that this notion does not kill Trapelot, objects are always half-sensual, and sensual objects are co-creations of at least two real objects. And this is what makes this network of objects, which gives the stability that makes objects persist in the first place and makes us identify facts as like stable, more denser parts of this network of objects. And this is what the interfact is.
I think that's beautifully put. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Adam.
The book is The Interfact, published in 2021 with Open Humanities Press. Gabriel Yoran, thank you so much for your time.
Adam, thanks for having me.